my dear Abraham. One could fill a cemetery with the women I have wept over. I do not wish to live without her, Henry. I know. She is too beautiful, too good. I know. Abe could not help his tears. The more precious his gift, said Henry, the more anxious God for its return. I must not be without her. Henry sat on the bed beside Abe, holding him in his arms, rocking him like a child, debating with himself. There is another way, he said at last. Abe sat up straight on the bed, ran a sleeve over his tears. The older of us, we can wake the deceased, provided the body is whole enough and less than a few weeks dead. It took Abe a moment to comprehend what Henry had said. Swear to me you speak the truth. She would live, Abraham, but I warn you, she would be cursed to live forever. Here was the answer to my grief, a way to see the smile of my beloved again, to feel her delicate fingers in mine. We would sit in the shade of our favorite tree, reading Shakespeare and Byron for all time, her finger carelessly twirling my hair as I lay in her lap. We would walk the years away on the banks of the Sangamon. The thought of it brought such relief, such bliss. But it was fleeting. For when I pictured her pale skin, her black eyes and hollow fangs, I felt nothing of the love we had shared. We would be united, yes, but it would be a cold finger gently twirling my hair, not in the shade of our favorite tree, but in the darkness of our curtained house. We would walk the years away on the banks of the Sangamon, but it would be only I who grew old. I was tempted to the point of madness, but I could not. I could not indulge the very darkness that had taken her from me, the very evil that had taken my mother. Anne Rutledge was laid to rest at the Old Concord Burial Ground on Sunday, August 30th. Abe stood silently as her coffin was lowered into the earth, a coffin he'd insisted on making himself. He'd inscribed a single line on its lid. In solitude, where we are least alone. Henry was waiting outside my cabin upon my return from the funeral. It was not yet midday, and he held a parasol over his head to shield his skin, dark glasses over his eyes. He asked me to follow him. Not a word passed between us as we walked a half mile into the woods to a small clearing. There I saw a pale, blond-haired little man tied to a post by his arms and ankles, stripped naked and gagged. Firewood and kindling had been piled at his feet, and a large jug placed on the ground near him. Abraham, said Henry, allow me to introduce Mr. John McNamara. He writhed at the sight of us, his skin covered in blisters and boils. He is quite new, said Henry, still sensitive to light. I felt the pine torch as it was placed in my hand, felt the heat on my face as it was lit, but my eyes never left John McNamara's. I expect he shall be even more sensitive to flame, said Henry. I could think of nothing to say. I could only look at him as I approached. He shook as I did, trying to free himself. I could not help but pity him. His fear, his helplessness. This is madness. Still, I longed to see him burn. I dropped the torch on the woodpile. He struggled against his bonds to no avail, screamed until his lungs bled with nary a sound. The flames grew waist high almost at once, forcing me back as his feet and legs began to blacken and burn. So great was the heat that his blonde hair blew continually upward, as if he stood in the gale. Henry remained close to the flames, nearer than I was able. With the jug in hand, he repeatedly poured water over McNamara's head, chest, and back, keeping him alive as his legs were burned to the bone, prolonging his agony. I felt tears on my face. I am dead. This went on for 10, perhaps 15 minutes until, at my insistence, he was finally allowed to die. Henry doused the flames and waited for the charred corpse to cool. Henry placed a gentle hand on Abe's shoulder. Abe brushed it away. "Why do you kill your own, Henry? And do me the honor of the truth, for I deserve as much." "I have never given you otherwise." "Then say it now and be done with it. Why do you kill your own? And why do I send you in my stead?" "Yes, yes, I know. My God, I forget how young you are." Henry ran a hand over his face. This was a conversation he had hoped to avoid. "Why do I kill my own? I have given you my answer. Because it is one thing to feed on the blood of the old and the sick and the treacherous, but quite another to take sleeping children from their beds, quite another to march men and women to their deaths in chains, as you have seen with your own eyes." "Then why me? Why not kill them yourself?" Henry paused to collect his thoughts. "When I rode here from St. Louis," he said at last, "I knew that you would not be dead when I arrived. I knew it with all my heart, because I know your purpose." Abe lifted his eyes to meet Henry's. "Most men have no purpose but to exist, Abraham, to pass quietly through history as minor characters upon a stage they cannot even see, to be the playthings of tyrants. But you were born to fight tyranny. It is your purpose, Abraham, to free men from the tyranny of vampires. It has always been your purpose, since you first sprang from your mother's womb, and I have seen it emanating from your every pore since the night we first met, shining from you as brightly as the sun. Do you think that it was some accident that brought us together? Do you think it was mere chance that the first vampire I sought to kill in more than 100 years was the one who led me to you? I can see a man's purpose, Abraham. It is my gift. I can see it as clearly as I see you standing before me now. Your purpose is to fight tyranny,
and mine is to see that you win."
Seven. The Fatal First. I have now come to the conclusion never again to think of marrying, and for this reason, I can never be satisfied with anyone who would be blockhead enough to have me. Abraham Lincoln, in a letter to Mrs. Orville H. Browning, April 1, 1838. 1. Abe was on the second floor of a plantation house. He'd seen so many of them on his trips down the Mississippi. The oversized four-column wonders built by the hands of slaves. But he'd never been inside, not until tonight. I held Jack in my arms, his innards visible through the slit that ran across his belly. I saw the color leave his face, saw the fear in his eyes, and then the nothingness. My brave, sturdy friend, the roughest man in Clary's Grove, gone. And yet I could not grieve him now, for I too remained perilously close to death. It had been another simple errand, another name on Henry's list. But this place was different, extraordinary. Abe was on his knees, certain he'd stumbled into some kind of vampire hive. How many there were, I did not know. I set Jack's body down and entered a long second-floor hallway, axe in hand.
my long coat torn by the very claws that had taken my friend's life. Open doors ran the length of this corridor, and as I walked cautiously forward, each revealed a scene more horrid than the last. In one, the tiny bodies of three children hung from ropes by their ankles, their throats cut, pails placed beneath them to catch their blood. In another, the withered, wide-eyed corpse of a woman in a rocking chair. One of her skeletal hands rested atop the head of a child in her lap, not quite as decayed as she. Down the corridor, the remains of a woman lying in bed. Farther, a squat vampire with a stake through his heart. All the while I heard the sounds of the floors creaking around me, above and below. I crept down the corridor, closer to the grand staircase at its end. On reaching its railing, I turned back to perceive the whole of the hallway. Suddenly there was a vampire before me, though I could not see his face against the light. He took the axe from my hand and threw it aside, lifted me clear off the ground by my collar. Now I saw his face. It was Henry. "It is your purpose to free men from tyranny, Abraham," he said, "and to do so, you must die." Upon this he threw me over the railing. My body fell toward the foyer's marble floor, and fell for all time. It was the last nightmare Abe would ever have in New Salem. It had taken him months to emerge from the crippling depression brought on by Anne's death, and while it had renewed his hatred of vampires, he found himself without the energy and passion to hunt them. Now, when a letter from St. Louis arrived in Henry's handwriting, it might go unopened for days, and once opened, it might be weeks before Abe attended to the name inside. Sometimes, if the errand required too much travel, he sent Jack Armstrong in his stead. His despondency is clear in an entry dated November 18, 1836. "I have given too much of myself already. Henceforth I shall hunt only when it is convenient for me to do so, and only because it honors the memory of my angel mother, only because it honors Anne's memory. I care not for the unsuspecting gentleman on the darkened city street. I care not for the negro sold at auction, or the child taken from its bed. Protecting them has not profited me in the least. On the contrary, it has left me even poorer, for the items my errands require are furnished at my own expense, and the days and weeks spent hunting are days and weeks without a wage. If what Henry says is the truth, if I am truly meant to free men from tyranny, then I must begin by freeing myself. There is nothing for me here in New Salem. The store has failed, and I fear the village is not far behind. Henceforth, my life shall be my own." Abe had been encouraged to pursue law by his old Black Hawk war friend John T. Stewart, who had a small practice in Springfield. After studying entirely on his own, and only in his spare time, Abe obtained a law license in the fall of 1836. Shortly thereafter, Stewart asked him to partner up. On April 12, 1837, the two men ran an advertisement in the Sangamon Journal, announcing their new venture, located in Springfield at No. 4 Hoffman's Row, upstairs. 3 days later, Abe rode solemnly into Springfield on a borrowed horse, carrying everything he owned in a pair of saddlebags. He was 28 years old, and he was penniless. "The whole of my money going toward my debts, and the requisite books of my new profession." He tied up outside of A.Y. Ellis & Company, a general store on the west side of the square, and moseyed in with not so much as an acorn in my pocket. The clerk was a slender man named Joshua Fry Speed, 24 years old, with jet-black hair and a graceful face that framed two unnervingly blue eyes. I found him at once odd and bothersome. "Are you new to Springfield, sir? May I interest you in a hat, sir? What news from the county, sir? Must you routinely stoop to fit through doorways, sir?" Never had I been asked so many questions. Never had I been so unwillingly dragged into conversation. I would not have dreamt of treating my customers in such a way during my own tenure as a clerk. I could not go from one shelf to the next without him buzzing about like a horsefly asking questions, when all I cared to do was conclude my business and be on my way. To this end, I handed him a list of goods, including the chemicals I required for my hunts.
"You will forgive my saying so," said Speed, "but these are strange requests indeed."
"They are what I require. I should be glad to furnish you with the names of the..."
"Strange indeed. Sir, are you certain we have not met?"
"Sir, are you able to order them or not?"
"Yes, I'm sure of it. Yes, yes, I saw you give a speech July last at Salisbury on the need for improving the Sangamon. Do you not remember, sir? Joshua Speed, a fellow Kentuckian?"
"Well, I really must be on my..."
"A fine speech indeed. Of course, I believe you quite mistaken on the subject. Every dollar spent on that miserable creek is a dollar wasted. But what a speech!"
He pledged to order the whole of my list at once, and much to the relief of my weary ears, busied himself copying its contents. Before taking my leave, I inquired as to whether he knew of any rooms for rent, preferably cheap ones, as I had no money to pay at the moment.
"Well, sir, if you have no money, am I to take your meaning as cheap or free?"
"On credit."
"Ah, credit, yes. You will forgive my saying so, but I have learned that credit is a French word meaning I shall never pay you."
"I square my debts."
"Oh, I doubt it not, I doubt it not. All the same, sir, you shall not find such a room in Springfield. People here are strangely accustomed to trading their wares for money."
"I see. Well, thank you for your time. Good day." Perhaps he pitied my circumstances or my weary countenance. Perhaps he was merely as friendless as I. In any case, he stopped me and offered to share his own room above the store.
"On credit, until such time as you're able to strike out on your own."
I will admit that I considered refusing him. The idea of sharing a room with such a pestering fly. I should rather take my chances in a stable loft. But, having no better option, I thanked him and accepted.
"You will, of course, require time to move," said Speed.
Abe walked outside. A moment later, he returned with his saddlebags and set them on the floor. "I am moved."
2. Springfield was booming. Wooden shacks and ox carts were giving way to brick buildings and carriages, and there seemed to be two politicians for every farmer. It was a long way from New Salem, and even farther from the frontier hardship of Little Pigeon Creek. But for all the excitement and advantage of urban life, there also came a cruelty that Abe was unaccustomed to. His description of one incident is a window into the growing violence of a growing city, and further evidence of Lincoln's lingering melancholy. "I witnessed a woman and her husband shot and killed today, the latter being the responsible party in both deaths. I was on the street in front of our office, talking with a client, Mr. John S. Wilborn, when I heard a scream and saw a woman of perhaps 35 years running out of Thompson's, footnote, a boarding house on the next block of Hoffman's Row. A man came running after her with the pepper box, footnote, a small 3-barreled pistol capable of firing 3 shots, one from each barrel, without reloading. Leveled it and shot her square in the back. She fell face forward in the street, grabbing at her gut, then rolled onto her back and made an effort to sit upright. She could not. Wilborn and I raced toward her at once, caring not that her husband stood over her, pistol in hand. Others came into the street, alerted by the noise, and as they did, they were met with the sound of a second shot. This one left a hole in the husband's head. He, too, fell, blood pouring from the wound with every beat of his heart. It is a strange thing how quickly the body dies, how fragile a force our presence is. In an instant, the soul is gone, leaving an empty, insignificant vessel in its stead. I have read of those sent to the gallows and guillotines of Europe. I have read of the great wars of ages past, and men slaughtered by the tens of thousands, and we give but fleeting consideration to their deaths, for it is our nature to banish such thoughts. But in doing so, we forget that they were each as alive as we, and that one length of rope, one bullet or blade, took the whole of their lives in that last fragile instant, took their earliest days as swaddled infants, and their grayest unfulfilled futures. When one thinks of how many souls have suffered this fate in all of history, of the untold murders of untold men, women, and children, it is too much to bear. Fortunately, Lincoln's duties as a lawyer and lawmaker kept him too busy to dwell on death for very long. When he wasn't required at a committee hearing or a vote, he was likely deposing a client in his office or filing a suit at the Springfield courthouse. Most of his cases concerned land disputes or unpaid debts. Twice a year, Abe joined a group of his fellow lawyers on a 3-month tour of the 8th Judicial Circuit, an area made up of 14 counties in central and eastern Illinois. There were dozens of settlements on the circuit and precious few courthouses. So when the weather permitted, the courthouse came to them, lawyers, judge, and all. For Abe, these trips were more than an escape from the long, candlelit hours at his desk. They were a chance to catch up on his vampire hunts. Knowing that my work would take me twice yearly around the circuit, I deferred certain errands until such time as they were more suitable. By day, my fellow lawyers and I tried cases, using churches or taverns as our courts. In the evenings, we gathered at the supper table and discussed the business of the coming day. And at night, when all but a few were asleep in the overstuffed rooms of our boarding house, I ventured out with my coat and axe. One hunt in particular stood out in Abe's memory. I'd received a letter from Henry bearing the instructions, E. Schildhouse, half mile beyond the north end of Mill Street, Athens, Illinois. Rather than set out straight away and dispense God's justice, I chose to wait until such time as my work brought me to Athens. And so arrived the day, 2 months later, when our traveling mob was due in the little town to the north, and the lawyers gathered at the tavern that was to serve as our courthouse. Here, they were introduced to the plaintiffs and defendants whose cases they would argue in just a few hours' time. Having been sick most of the night before, I was unable to join Stuart until midday, by which time our case was already before the judge. It was a matter of some small debt owed by our client, an older red-haired woman named Betsy. I recall only that we lost, and that I contributed nothing to the effort beyond a parting, apologetic handshake with her, much distracted by my illness. That night, Stuart having turned in along with most of our mob, I unpacked my coat and axe and quietly made for the address on Henry's letter. As I was feeling feverish, I had elected to simply knock on the door and drive my axe into whoever opened it, so that I might return to bed with the utmost expediency. The door swung open. It was my client, Betsy, her red hair held in place by an ivory comb. I closed my coat in hopes of hiding the axe beneath it.
"May I help you, Mr. Lincoln?"
I apologize for intruding at this late hour, ma'am. I must be mistaken."
"Oh?"
"Yes, ma'am. I understood this to be the home of an E. Schildhouse."
"Well, indeed it is. A vampire and a woman under one roof? Mr. Lincoln, you must excuse my asking, but are you well? You look rather pallid."
"Fine, ma'am, thank you. Do you think I might speak with Mr. Schildhouse a moment?"
"Mr. Lincoln," she said, laughing, "you are speaking with her. E. Schildhouse. Elizabeth. Betsy." She caught sight of the axe in my coat, read my face, my eyes, my thoughts. At once I was on my back fighting to keep her fangs from my neck, my axe knocked out of reach. I pulled at her red hair with my right hand and reached into my coat with the left. Here I found a small knife, which I used to stab any part of her that I could reach, her neck, her back, the very arm she pinned me with.
I brought the blade down again and again, until at last she released me and sprang to her feet. I did the same, and we circled each other cautiously, I holding the knife in front of my body, she staring at me with those black marbles. Then, just as quickly as she had attacked, she stopped and held her hands in the air as if to surrender.
I must know, what quarrel have we, Mr. Lincoln?
Your quarrel is with God. I merely wish to offer him the opportunity to judge you.
Very good, she laughed. That is very good. Well, for your sake, I pray you are a better combatant than you are a lawyer.
She struck at me, and in doing so knocked the knife from my hand, my strength diminished by fever. Her fists flew about my face and belly faster than I could perceive them, and I tasted the salt of fresh blood in my mouth. She drove me back with each blow, until I could no longer keep my feet steady beneath me. For the first time since the night Henry had saved my life, I felt death looking over my shoulder. Henry was wrong. I collapsed, and she was on me at once, my arm shaking as I again held her by the hair. And then her fangs were in my shoulder, the pain of punctured flesh and muscle, the heat of blood rushing to the wound, the pressure in my veins. I stopped pulling at her hair and laid my hand flat upon her head, as if comforting a friend in a time of grief. All apprehension left me now, all pain, the warmth of whiskey, an unknown joy. These are the last moments of my life. I struck the martyr against the ivory comb in her hair. It lit, brighter than the sun, a halo behind her head. Her red hair burst into flame, and I felt her fangs leave me, heard her screams as she rolled on the ground, the fire spreading to her clothes, refusing to let her go. With the last of my strength, I got to my knees, retrieved my axe, and buried it in her brain. She was no more, but I had not the strength to bury her, or walk the mile to my boarding house. I dragged her body inside, closed the door, and, after helping myself to a torn strip of her bedsheets to dress my wounds, helped myself to her bed. I do not expect I shall ever again have the opportunity of defending and murdering a client in the same day. When Abe rode circuit, his hunts were confined to darkness. But when he worked out of Springfield, he grew increasingly fond of hunting during the day. One of my favorite tricks was setting a sleeping vampire's house alight when the sun was highest in the sky. This left the devil with two unsavory options: meet me in the daylight, where he would be weak and half blind, or remain inside and burn. I cared not which he chose. By the time Abe won re-election to the state legislature in 1838, he was becoming known around Springfield as an eloquent speaker and capable lawyer. A man with ability and ambition to match, a man worthy of esteem. He was 29 years old, and in just over a year's time, he'd gone from a penniless newcomer on a borrowed horse to a man who moved with the capital's elite, though, thanks to his debts, he remained penniless. He charmed dinner party guests with his backwoods folksiness and impressed fellow legislators with his easy grasp of the issues. His table manners are a bit rough, wrote fellow Whig Ebenezer Ryan to a friend, and his suit's in need of mending, but he is possessed of the finest mind I have ever known, and has a gift for forming his thoughts into eloquent turns of phrase. I expect he could be governor some day. Abe also thought less often of Ann Rutledge. It is true what they say of time. I find my melancholy much improved of late, and take to my errands with renewed zeal. Mother sends news that she and my half-siblings are in good health. Footnote: Abe had by now taken to calling Sarah Bush Lincoln Mother. It's worth noting that he doesn't mention his father. I have a fine partner in Stuart, a pestilent but well-meaning friend in Speed, and the respect of the finest men in Springfield. Were it not for my debts, I should be the happiest of men, and yet I cannot escape the feeling that there is something missing. John T. Stuart had a plan.
It had taken some convincing, but he'd finally managed to drag his junior partner to the cotillion at his cousin Elizabeth's.
Having much business to attend to, I did not think it a good use of my time, yet Stuart kept at me, pestering me as his stepbrother John had years before.
"Life is more than papers, Lincoln. Come now, it shall do our health wonders to be out among people."
This continued for the better part of an hour, until I had no choice but relent. On reaching the Edwards's house, before I had so much as shaken the snow from my soles, Stuart whisked me through the house and introduced me to a young lady seated in the parlor. It was then that his scheme became clear.
Her name was Mary Todd, Stuart's cousin, and a new arrival to Springfield. Abe recorded his first impressions of her that very night, December 16, 1839.
"She is a fascinating creature. Just this week turned 1 in 20, but so gifted in conversation, and not in the stilted, learned manner of excessive breeding, but rather in a natural, God-given way. A tiny, witty thing with a pleasing round face and dark hair, fluent in French, trained in dance and music. My eye could not help but return to her time and time again. More than once I caught her staring back, her hand cupped to the ear of a friend, both laughing at my expense. Oh, I'm keen to know her more." When the evening was all but concluded and I could bear it no longer, I greeted her with a low bow, saying, "Miss Todd, I want to dance with you in the worst way." Legend has it that Mary later told friends, and he certainly did. She was strangely drawn to the tall, unrefined lawyer. Despite the gulf of wealth and breeding that divided them, there were a few crucial similarities that would form the basis of their relationship. Both lost their mothers at a young age, and continued to be defined by that loss. Both were decisive, emotional creatures, prone to soaring highs and abyssal lows. And both enjoyed nothing more than a good joke, especially when it came at the expense of some deserving charlatan. As Mary would write in her diary that winter, "He is not the handsomest suitor I have ever known, nor the most refined, but he is without question the cleverest. Yet there is a sadness that accompanies his wit. I find him quite strange, strange yet intriguing." But as much as she was intrigued by Abe, Mary was torn, for she was already being courted by a short, stocky Democrat named Stephen A. Douglas. Douglas was a rising star in his party and a man of considerable means, especially when compared to Lincoln. He could provide Mary with the lifestyle she'd grown accustomed to. But while he was undeniably brilliant and undeniably rich, he was also, in Mary's words, undeniably dull. "In the end," she recalled in a letter written years later, "I decided that it was more important to laugh than eat." She and Abe became engaged in late 1840. But while the two were in hearty love and a hurry to get hitched, there was still the small matter of getting permission from Mary's father. The young couple wouldn't have to wait long for his answer. Mary's parents were due in Springfield for Christmas. It was to be Abe's first encounter with his future in-laws. Robert Smith Todd was a wealthy businessman and a fixture in Lexington, Kentucky society. Like Abe, he was both lawyer and lawmaker. Unlike Abe, he'd amassed a great deal of wealth, some of which he'd used to purchase slaves for the mansion that he shared with his second wife and some of their 15 children. "I am unnerved at the prospect of being judged by a man of such influence and accomplishments. What if he should think me a fool or a peasant? What then of our love? I can think of nothing else. It has given me no shortage of worry these 2 weeks." Abe needn't have worried. The meeting went better than he could have hoped, at least according to the poem Mary dashed off to Lexington the next day, December 31st. "My darling Abe was at his best, our darling father most impressed. The happy news, you might have guessed, is that our union has been blessed." As one postwriter carried her poem to Lexington, another delivered a letter to her newly blessed fiancé. It was addressed "Urgent" in Henry's unmistakable scrawl, and carefully worded, as all the letters that passed between he and Abe were, to avoid any direct mention of vampires, lest it be delivered to the wrong hands.
"Dearest Abraham, received your letter of 18th December. Please accept my heartiest congratulations on your engagement. Miss Todd seems to be possessed of many fine qualities, and judging by your lengthy description of each, you have clearly been possessed by them. However, I must caution you, Abraham, and I do so only after much deliberation, for I know that this letter will not come as welcome news. The woman to whom you are engaged is the daughter of a Mr. Robert Smith Todd, known to all of Lexington as a gentleman of means and might. But know the truth, that his power is built on treacherous ground, that he is more a friend to my kind than yours, that his allies are the very worst of us, the sort whose names I have sent you these many years. He has been their champion in the State House, their private bank in matters of business. He has even profited from the sale of Negroes intended for the cruelest of fates. It is not my intention to discourage you from the match, for the daughter cannot be held to account for the sins of the father. However, being so intimately connected with such a man could prove dangerous. I ask only that you give the matter serious consideration and keep your wits about you, whatever your decision may be. Yours ever, H. History would remember the next day as Lincoln's fatal 1st of January. Well, it is done. I have destroyed the woman I love without so much as an explanation. I have destroyed her happiness and my own. I am the most miserable creature that ever lived, and I deserve whatever sorrows are in store. I expect, nay, I hope, there will be many. Abe had called on Mary that morning and broken off the engagement, muttering through his tears, I recall not a word of it, before running out into the cold. I knew that I would never be able to shake her father's hand again, nor look him in the eye without betraying my rage. To think that my children would share his blood, a man who conspired against his own kind, a man who profited from the deaths of innocents, their color be damned, I could not bear it. And what was I to do? Tell Mary the truth? Impossible. I had but one choice. For the second time in 5 years, his thoughts turned to suicide, and for the second time in 5 years, it was his mother's dying wish that kept him from following through. John T. Stewart was visiting with relatives. All but a few of his fellow legislators had left to welcome the new year in their respective districts. There was only one person in all of Springfield whom Abe could turn to.
"But you were in love with her," said Speed. "Why in the devil would you go and do such a stupid thing?"
Abe sat on his bed in the tiny room above A.Y. Ellison Company, the bed he shared with the half-mad, pestering fly buzzing about the room. "I ache to be with her, Speed, but I cannot."
"On account of her father? The same man who gave you his blessing not 6 or 8 days ago?"
"The same."
"You ache to be with her. Her father has given his blessing. You must explain how courtship works here in Illinois, for I have clearly misunderstood some part of it."
"I have since learned that her father is a party to wickedness, that he keeps the worst kind of company. I can have none of it."
"If I loved a woman as you love Mary, her father could dine with the devil himself and it would not alter my affections."
"You do not understand."
"Then make me understand. How can I be of any use if all you do is speak in riddles?"
Abe could feel it on the tip of his tongue.
"You can trust me to keep any secret, Lincoln."
"When you say dine with the devil, well, you are closer to the truth than you know. I say he keeps company of the worst kind. What I mean to say is, he is a friend of evil, Speed. A friend of creatures who care not for human life. Creatures who would kill you or me and feel all the remorse of an elephant who stepped on an ant."
"Ah, You mean he's a friend of vampires?
Abe felt the blood leave his fingertips.
3.
Joshua Speed had never felt at home with the other well-bred boys of St. Joseph's Academy. He liked to play pranks, tell jokes. He liked to dream of life on the wild frontier, where men were few and arrows flew. He couldn't stand the thought of suffering his father's quiet life of privilege. He yearned for something more, to strike out on his own and see the world. When he was 19, this yearning led him to Springfield, where he bought a stake in A.Y. Ellis. But filling orders and keeping inventory hadn't proved the wild frontier he was looking for. In early 1841, not long after Abe's fatal 1st of January, Speed sold his interests and returned to Kentucky, leaving Lincoln to enjoy the room above the store by himself. Arrived at Farmington. Must sleep. It was August, and Abe had come to the Speed family's Kentucky estate, Farmington, for some much-needed time away from his troubles. He hadn't ventured out in months for fear of running into Mary or her friends, and his name was treated as a profanity in every parlor in Springfield. Speed had written his old roommate and insisted he come for as long as is necessary to heal your troubles. Abe was more relaxed than he had been in years, or ever would be again. He took leisurely rides around the estate on horseback, ventured into Lexington, lazed afternoons away on the porch of the giant plantation house, the first he had actually set foot inside, his nightmares notwithstanding. If there was one drawback to life at Farmington, it was the inescapable sight of slaves. They were everywhere, in the house, in the fields. Riding on the road to town today, I saw a dozen Negroes chained together, like so many fish upon a trot line. It causes me no small discomfort to be among them, to be surrounded by them, not only because I think their servitude a sin, but because they remind me of all that I wish to forget. Abe and Joshua Speed talked the days away. They spoke of Britain's might, of the steam engine, and they spoke of vampires. "My own father dealt with the devils, I'm ashamed to say," said Speed. "They were hardly a secret among men of his stature, and a poorly kept one in our home, my older brothers having been enlisted in his efforts to win their favor. So he sold Negroes to them. The old and the lame, as a rule, he believed it a double blessing, a way to be rid of a useless slave and make a profit doing so. Once or twice he sold off a healthy buck or a wench with child. Those fetched a higher price as they had more blood."
"Enough! How can you speak of them so? Speak of men as cattle led to slaughter."
"If I have given the impression that I take their murders lightly, I apologize. I do not, Abe, nor have I ever. To the contrary, vampires are chief among the reasons that I never sought the warmth of my father's esteem, or mourned his passing with more than a few tears. How could I accept it, when I have heard the screams of men and women feasted upon to line his pockets, when I have seen the faces of those demons through the spaces between wooden planks? If I could banish it from my memory, if I could atone for what was done here, I would do so."
"Then atone for it."
Speed needed little convincing. He needed only be told that hunting vampires was both dangerous and thrilling, much like the wild frontier of his imagination. As I had with Jack, footnote, Jack Armstrong had decided to remain in Clary's Grove when Abe moved to Springfield, effectively ending their brief partnership. I shared the whole of my knowledge, teaching him how and when to strike, sparring with him to build his poise. Like Jack, he was impatient, too eager to run headlong into the fight. But where Jack could rely on his strength to carry the day, the slender Speed could not. I tried to impress upon him the immense force and quickness possessed by vampires, how very close he would be to death. I feared he did not fully understand. Yet such was his eager spirit that I found myself once again excited at the prospect of hunting. Abe came up with an audacious plan,
one that would put his inexperienced friend at minimal risk and kill 6 birds with 1 stone. In late August, Joshua Speed wrote a letter to 6 of his father's former associates, each a frequent buyer of unwanted slaves, each a vampire.
The day having arrived, I found myself filled with apprehension. How could I have been so rash? 6 vampires, and with a novice as my partner. How I wished we had more time. How I wished we had Jack by our side.
But it was too late to turn back. 6 men joined Joshua Speed on the shaded porch of the Overseers. Footnote: a 4-room house on the Farmington estate, roughly a 0.5 mile from the main residence. 1, a gray-bearded man of 70. 1, boyish and barely in his 20s. The other 4 in between. All of them wore dark glasses and carried folded parasols.
Speed had arranged for several Negroes to gather near the house and instructed them to make merry with their gospel. Such was their singing and clapping that one could hear little else while waiting on the porch outside. As we had planned, Speed invited the vampires in one by one, taking their money and leading them to the waiting feast inside. 5 can't catch me and 10 can't hold me. Hoe round the corn, Sally. But it was I who waited with my axe, and on their rounding the corner from the hall to the parlor, I swung it at their throats with the whole of my strength, which in those days was considerable. Of the first 5 vampires, all but 1 had his head taken on the first try. Only the 3rd required a 2nd effort, the blade having lodged in his face instead of his neck. I can bank, Jenny bank, Jenny bank the weaver, hoe round the corn, Sally. The last vampire was the youngest in appearance, but elderly in spirit. He grew annoyed at being made to wait on the porch alone, and helped himself inside the house. Unfortunately, he did so just as the head of his colleague rolled into the hall. The boyish vampire ran to his waiting horse, jumped on its back without breaking stride, and galloped off. Speed was first through the door. He jumped on the 2nd horse, dug his heels in, and gave chase before I could even mount the 3rd. It was an old-fashioned horse race now, and Speed rode reckless, standing on his stirrups and beating his foot against the animal's belly. The vampire saw him gaining and did the same, but his horse was a good 10 years slower. Speed pulled up alongside without so much as a pocket knife to stab him with or a pebble to throw. Speed pulled his feet from the stirrups 1 at a time, held the horn of his saddle with 2 hands, and stood. With both horses in a full gallop, he jumped, grabbing the vampire and dragging him to the ground. Both men tumbled in the dirt as their horses sped on. Speed struggled to his feet, dizzy, the sun blinding. Before he'd had time to shake the dust from his ears, a fist knocked him 10 yards through the air and onto his back. He gasped for breath and brought a hand to his face, where a gash had been opened on his left cheek. The sun was suddenly eclipsed by the shape of a vampire standing over him. "You ungrateful little cur," he said. Speed felt his innards rattle as the vampire delivered a kick to his gut. "Who do you suppose paid for all this land?" Another kick. Another. Speed saw flashes of color with the pain. Felt his mouth fill with a strange taste. He couldn't help but be sick. The vampire grabbed him by the collar. "Your father would be ashamed," he said.
"I certainly hope so," muttered Speed.
The vampire raised a clawed hand and prepared to bring it down on Speed's throat. Fortunately, the head of an axe burst through his chest before he had the chance. As the vampire fell to his knees, grabbing helplessly at the blade, blood pouring from his mouth, Abe pulled up on his reins and dismounted, quickly placing 2 hands on the handle and 1 foot on the vampire's back. He freed the axe, then delivered a fatal blow to the creature's skull. "Speed," he said, rushing to his friend's side. "My God."
"Well,
said Speed. I believe that's enough atonement for one day.
Abe found Springfield lonesome and lifeless upon his return. His time at Farmington had done wonders for his melancholy, but with no friend to share my lonely hours, what difference if I be in the happiest or worst of moods? I care not that Mary's father is a scoundrel, only that I love his daughter unconditionally. Speed is right. What is there in the world but our own small happiness? I have given the matter my serious consideration. Let Henry protest. Let the consequences come. I have resolved to pledge myself anew if she will have me.
And why should I marry the man who left me to suffer alone? Asked Mary as Abe stood in the doorway of her cousin's house. The man who left me without so much as an explanation?
Abe looked down at the hat in his hands.
I do not. Who made a mockery of my name in this city?
My dearest Mary, I have only my humble.
Pray, what sort of husband would such a man make? A man who, at any moment, might suffer a change of heart and leave me to suffer anew? Tell me, Mr. Lincoln, what enticement have I to pledge myself to such a man?
Abe looked up from his hat. Mary, he said, if it is my faults you wish to address, then we shall find ourselves standing here a week's time. I do not come to torment you further. I come to merely lay myself at your feet, to beg your forgiveness. I come with a pledge to spend my life reconciling whatever grief I have caused you these long months. If my offer is insufficient, if the sight of me brings you anything other than happiness, then you may close that door knowing that my face shall never trouble you again.
Mary stood in silence.
Abe took a small step back, expecting the door to be slammed in his face at any moment.
Oh, Abraham, I love you still. She cried, and leapt into his arms.
Their engagement resumed. Abe wasted no time. He bought 2 gold wedding rings, on credit, of course, at Chatterin's in Springfield. He and Mary settled on a simple engraving to grace the inside of both. Love is eternal. Abraham Lincoln and Mary Todd were married on a rainy Friday evening on November 4, 1842. In the home of Elizabeth Edwards, Mary's cousin. In all, there were fewer than 30 guests looking on as they exchanged vows. After the ceremony, Mary and I stole away to the parlor while dinner was served, so that we might spend our first moments as husband and wife in quiet solitude. We shared a tender kiss or two, and looked at each other with a certain perplexity, for it was a strange thing to be married, a strange and wonderful thing.
My darling Abraham, said Mary at last, do not ever leave me again.
4. On May 11, 1843, Abe wrote to Joshua Speed.
What a wonder these months have been, Speed. What bliss! Mary is as devoted and loving a wife as one could want, and I am pleased, Speed, so very pleased to share the happy news that she is with child. We are both overjoyed, and Mary has already begun the task of preparing our home for the arrival. What a fine mother she will make. Please write me immediately, for I wish to know how your recovery is progressing.
The evening of August 1, 1843, was an unusually hot one, and the open window did little to relieve the heat in Abe and Mary's tiny second-floor room at the Globe Tavern. Passers-by looked up at the open window with intense curiosity as sounds bled into the night air, first of a woman's pain, and then of a shrill cry.
A son. Mother and child in the best of health. Mary has done perfectly. It is not 6 hours since the child's birth, and already she holds little Robert in her arms, singing to him sweetly. Abe, she said to me as he fed, look what we have done. I admit the tears filled my eyes. Oh, if only this moment could stretch on for all eternity.
Robert Todd Lincoln, Mary insisted, Abe held his tongue,
was born a scant 10 months after his parents' wedding day. I find myself staring at him for hours on end, holding him against my chest and feeling the gentle rhythms of his breath, running my fingers over the smooth skin of his fat, delightful feet. I admit that I smell his hair when he sleeps, nibble at his fingers when he holds them near. I am his servant, for I shall do anything to earn his slightest smile. Abe took to parenthood with a passion, but 2 decades of burying loved ones had taken their toll. As the months went on and Robert grew, Abe seemed increasingly obsessed with losing his son, whether to sickness or some imagined accident. In his journal entries, he began to do something he hadn't in years. He began to bargain with God. "My only wish is to see him become a man, to have his own family gathered beside him at my grave. Nothing else. I shall happily trade every ounce of my own happiness for his, my own accomplishments for his. Please, Lord, let no harm come to him. Let no misfortune befall him. If ever you require one to punish, I beg you, let it be me." In accordance with his hopes of seeing Robert reach adulthood, and in hopes of preserving the happiness he'd found in married life, Abe came to a difficult decision in the autumn of 1843. "My dance with death must end. I cannot risk leaving Mary without a husband, nor Robert without a father. I have this very morning written Henry and told him that he should no longer count on my axe." After 20 years of battling vampires, the time had come to hang up his long coat for good. And after 8 years in the state legislature, his moment to be recognized had come as well. In 1846, he was nominated as the Whig candidate for the United States Congress. 8. Some Great Calamity. The true rule in determining to embrace or reject anything is not whether it have any evil in it, but whether it have more of evil than of good. There are few things wholly evil or wholly good. Abraham Lincoln, in a speech in the House of Representatives, June 20, 1848. 1. When Abe retired from hunting in late 1843, he left one of Henry's errands unfinished. "I made innocent mention of this in letters to Armstrong and Speed, and, as had secretly been my hope, both expressed interest in completing it. Because they remained relative strangers to the art of hunting vampires, I thought it best if they worked together." Joshua Speed and Jack Armstrong met for the first time in St. Louis on April 11, 1844. If Speed's letter to Abe, written 3 days later, is any indication, it didn't go well. "As your letter instructed, we met at the tavern on Market Street yesterday, midday. Your description of Armstrong was precise, Abe. He is more bull than man, broader than a barn and stronger than Samson himself. Yet you failed to mention that he is also a cur, as thick-skulled as he is thick. You must forgive my saying so, for I know he is your friend, but never in my 30 years have I encountered a more disagreeable, pugnacious, humorless man. It is obvious why you recruited him, for the same reason one recruits a big, dumb ox to pull a heavy cart. But why you, a man of the finest mind and temperament, would keep his company otherwise, I shall never comprehend." Armstrong never wrote about his impressions of Speed, but it's likely they were just as unflattering. The wealthy, dashing Kentuckian was spirited and chatty, qualities that Armstrong would have found irksome in the toughest of men. Speed, however, was soft-handed and slight, the very kind of dandy that the Clary's Grove boys would have stuffed in a barrel and sent down the Sangamon. "Out of nothing more than respect for you, dear friend, we agreed to forego our grievances and see the errand through." Their target was a well-known professor named Dr. Joseph Nash McDowell, Dean of Medicine at Kemper College. Henry had warned me about McDowell, The doctor was an especially paranoid specimen, he'd said. Paranoid to the extent that he wore an armor breastplate beneath his clothes at all times, lest some assassin tried to stake him through the heart. I related this to Armstrong and Speed, and added my own warning. Because McDowell's death would likely cause a stir in St. Louis, they must take care to remain unseen during the errand, and avoid making inquiries as to the doctor's whereabouts. To do either would be disastrous. Armstrong and Speed did both. The reluctant duo stood at the corner of 9th and Sarah Streets that April afternoon, each in a conspicuous, bulging long coat, asking every man who entered the four-story medical building, "Sir, do you know where we might find Dr. Joseph McDowell?" At last, we were directed to a steep circular lecture hall, a miniature coliseum of ever-expanding rows and railings, upon which curious gentlemen rested their hands, their faces illuminated by the hissing gas lights of the surgical table below, their eager eyes trained on the wild-haired, pale figure cutting into the flesh of a male corpse. We took our places on the uppermost level and watched Dr. McDowell remove the heart and hold it up for all to see.
"Banish all poetic notions from your minds," he said. "What I hold here knows nothing of love or courage. It knows only rhythmic contraction."
McDowell squeezed the heart in his hand several times.
"A single beautiful purpose, to keep fresh, rich blood flowing to every corner of the flesh."
A vampire teaching anatomy to men. Can you imagine it, Abe?
I must say, I rather like the fellow's cheek.
He cut further into the corpse as his demonstration continued, removing and discussing organs until at last the dead man resembled a gutted fish. Armstrong was rendered weak-kneed for the whole. I, on the other hand, found it all quite fascinating. The lecture ended to the polite tapping of canes against railings, and McDowell's students filed out, all but two. After hurriedly gathering his instruments and papers, the doctor made haste to a small door at the rear of his stage and disappeared. Armstrong and Speed followed. We wound down a narrow stone stairway in complete darkness, feeling our way along the rough, wet walls, until at last our hands met something smooth. I struck a match against my heel, and a black door appeared before us. The words J.N. McDowell, M.D., private, in gold paint. Out came my pistol and Armstrong's crossbow. Out went the match. My heart presently took to its single beautiful purpose with great enthusiasm, for we knew that a vampire waited on the other side of the dark. Speed felt his way to the knob and pulled it quietly, quietly open. Sunlight. Here was a long, tall room with smooth walls. High above our heads, a row of small windows let in the soft light of late day and framed the feet of passers-by. To our right, a long table of caged rats, glass vessels, and silver instruments. Ahead, what appeared to be a body on a stone slab, covered by a white sheet. And to our left, Abe, to our left, naked corpses ran the length of the room, each on a narrow shelf, stacked one atop the other to a height of 7 or 8 feet. We were in a morgue. I'd expected to find the doctor waiting for us, to be attacked at once, but there was no trace of him. Armstrong and I moved slowly toward the slab, our weapons at the ready. Only now did I see the dark glass tubes running over our heads, running from the bodies on our left to the vessels on our right. Only now did I see the blood running into those vessels, kept warm by a row of tiny glass flames beneath. Only now did I see the chests of those corpses moving with each shallow breath. And here the whole horror of it struck me, Abe. For now I realize these were all living men, packed onto shelves as books in a library, each given barely enough room for his chest to rise. Each kept fed through holes in their stomachs, drained, too weak to move, too nourished to die.
each imprisoned by the creature whose whistling we suddenly heard from an adjoining room. Whistling, washing his hands in a water basin, preparing, no doubt, to butcher the poor soul whose chest still rose and fell beneath that white sheet. And at once, our plan became clear.
McDowell returned wearing an apron and carrying his surgical instruments on a tray. He set these down, whistling all the while, and peeled back the white sheet. "This isn't the man I remember."
Armstrong sat bolt upright and fired his crossbow into the bastard's heart. His heart, Abe. I needn't tell you that the arrow merely bounced off with a clang, for the big dumb ox had forgotten about the breastplate. It was a costly mistake, Abe, for McDowell now revealed his true self and struck with his claws. Jack heard something clang against the stone floor. He looked down at where his crossbow had been a moment before. Neither it nor his right hand remained. His face went pale at the sight of blood running from his wrist and his severed hand upon the floor.
Jack's cries were loud enough to wake some of the barely living on the opposite shelves.
I had no choice but remove from hiding and fire my pistol at the vampire's head, but my shaking hands could not be trusted. The bullet sailed past him and into his precious glass vessels. Imagine the noise, Abe. Imagine the volume of blood that ran onto the stone floor. One might have drowned. Such was the delicacy of his creation that all of the overhead tubes now shattered in unison, the effect being a shower of blood from above.
"No," screamed McDowell. "You've ruined it."
I do not remember being struck. I only know that I was thrown into the shelves of bodies with enough force to break the bones of my right leg. The pain was more severe than any I had ever known, more severe even than the thrashing I'd received at Farmington. The whole of my body felt suddenly cold. I remember McDowell, a pair of him actually, for I had been rendered rather senseless by the blow, coming toward me as I lay helpless, the entire floor covered by an inch or more of blood. I remember the strange, amusing thought that a mortuary was as good a place to die as any. The warmth pouring down on all of us, the taste of it. And I remember McDowell suddenly grabbing at his face. The tip of an arrow had broken through the flesh beneath his right eye. The rest protruded from the back of his skull. Behind him, the big dumb ox held a shaking crossbow in his remaining hand. With an unnatural volume of blood rushing down his face, adding to the already grisly scene, the paranoid McDowell panicked and fled. Footnote. This brush would only deepen McDowell's paranoia. He left Kemper and founded his own college of medicine at 9th and Gradio Streets, outfitting the building with rooftop cannons and keeping a store of muskets on hand to ward off attack. He would go on to serve in the Confederate Army before disappearing from history altogether. The St. Louis building that housed his school is said to be haunted by his ghost, though no record of his death has ever surfaced. God be praised. We were but steps from the finest hospital in St. Louis. Armstrong and I helped each other up the stairs, I struggling along on my good leg and carrying his severed hand in one of mine, both of us soaked from head to toe in the blood of 24 men. The surgeons were able to save Jack's life. His hand is gone forever, Abe. He was quite close to death. Closer than he will likely admit. It was his strength that saw him through. His strength, and the prayers you doubtless said for our safety. I shall stay on long enough to see him well, though he refuses to speak to me. I am just now told that my leg shall heal, and that I shall walk with only the slightest limp, if any. Grieve not for your dear speed, friend, for he counts himself the most fortunate fool alive.
2. On August 3, 1846, Abe was elected to the United States House of Representatives. In December of 1847, well over a year after his election, Abe arrived in Washington with his family for the beginning of his term.
they took a small room at Mrs. Spriggs' boarding house, footnote, a modest two-story home that stood on the present-day site of the Library of Congress. A room made all the more cramped by the addition of a fourth family member.
"We are doubly blessed with another boy, Edward Baker, born this 10th of March, 1846. He is every bit the laughing rascal Bob is, though I suspect he has a sweeter disposition. My love is not diminished slightly at his being the second. I am every bit the servant of Eddie's smile, nibbling at his toes to make him laugh, smelling his hair when he sleeps, holding his sleeping chest to mine. What a simpleton these boys make of their father." This time there was no fear of Edward falling ill or dying, no bargaining with God, at least none that Abe saw fit to record in his journal. Perhaps he'd grown more confident as a parent. Perhaps he was simply too busy to obsess over it. Busy keeping tabs on his thriving law practice back in Springfield. Busy adjusting to a new city and a new level of political intensity. Busy with everything but hunting vampires. Henry's letters arrive monthly. He begs I reconsider. Insists that it is crucial I take up my errands again. I answer each one with the same simple truths, that I will not risk leaving my wife a widow or my children fatherless. If I am truly meant to free men from tyranny, I tell him, then I must do so in the spirit of that old adage concerning the pen and the sword. My sword has done its part. My pen must take me the rest of the way. Washington turned out to be a disappointment on nearly every level. Abe had come expecting a gleaming metropolis filled with men of the finest minds and dedicated to the service of their constituents. What he found were a few brilliant beacons in a fog of fools. As for his dreams of life in a big city, Washington, D.C. felt more like Louisville or Lexington, albeit with a handful of gleaming architectural wonders. A few palaces on a prairie, as Abe liked to say. The cornerstone of the Washington Monument had yet to be laid. Neither it nor the Capitol would be completed in his lifetime. One of Washington's greatest disappointments was its abundance of slaves. They worked at Mrs. Spriggs' boarding house where Abe stayed with his family. They were auctioned off on the streets he took to work. They were kept caged on the future site of the National Mall, where Abe's giant likeness would one day keep watch for all eternity. There is, in view from the windows of the Capitol, a sort of livery stable where droves of Negroes are collected, temporarily kept, and finally taken to southern markets, precisely like droves of horses. Men, chained together and sold. Here in the shadow of an institution founded on the promise that all men are created equal. Founded with cries of, "Give me liberty or give me death." It is more than any honorable man can bear. In one of the few highlights of his congressional career, Abe introduced a bill to outlaw slavery in the District of Columbia. He'd been careful to write it in such a way that it seemed neither severe to slave owners nor feeble to abolitionists. But there was only so much a first-term congressman could do, brilliant or not. The bill never came to a vote.